Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Alex Cavarez. Alex earned a BFA in painting from the University of Kansas and an MFA in printmaking from the University of Texas. Alex uses primarily graphite, colored pencils, and ink to create mixtures of abstract forms and patterns, along with odd and sometimes grotesque figures and scenes. In his most recent drawings, he has been producing dense, somewhat psychedelic compositions in either graphite or ink on gridded paper. Join me as Alex explains the different elements he includes in his drawings and the cycles his creative interests go through. How are you doing today?
All right, how's it going?
Good to meet you. And I thought, like we were saying, I think it's interesting that we share a commonality in going to KU. How did you end up there, just by out of curiosity?
I was living in Olathe.
Okay. Did you grow up in that area?
No. I mean, my family moved when I was 14, so we kind of ended up in KC.
Mm-hmm. And we also share a commonality in that we both have print backgrounds, and I'm always curious to know how people get interested in printmaking and turn to that as their medium. How did it happen for you?
Well, I was actually a painting major. Like, I still have my undergrad is in painting.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because I was mainly drawing, and you couldn't really do a drawing major, and you couldn't really get away with drawing as a painting major.
Yeah.
Printmaking was just kind of the closest.
Mm. So you just got involved with doing it there, and that was how you were introduced to it?
Well, yeah, and also once I started taking printmaking, or once I took a printmaking class, kind of, Michael and I just got along well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a nice group of people there at that time. Like Mark Hosford was mm-hmm. there at the same time. Like, we're still friends. We still collaborate every once in a while. There were, like, a lot of people that mm-hmm. kind of went through that class.
What kind of work were you making at the time? Is it comparable to what you were creating now?
It was much more immature and obnoxious, but yeah. Probably not that different.
Do you consider your work immature and obnoxious now?
I hope not. I mean, yeah. I'm pushing 40 here, so close to it. Yeah, it's a little too late to be doing that.
More mature in its obnoxiousness, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
And I was, I'd read through some of your artist statement, but I'd like to kind of hear you explain your work in, like, the simplest terms of, like, what it is you hope to do with your imagery, or how you'd hope people see it or react to it.
I mean, it depends, for one, I guess it depends which statement you read, and it also depends which work we're talking about. I'm kind of in a, I don't know if it's a bad habit, I mean, it was kind of a semi-conscious habit of shifting gears every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, for the last, I would say, decade, maybe a little over a decade, I've been kind of doing a body of work for a couple of years, then do a show, then take a year to figure things out, regroup, do a completely different body of work,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So usually, like, every 3 years or so, there's a pretty distinct shift.
Yeah, what I read was the rapid shift in ideological substance creates the potential for glitches, and the small transitional failures between styles and ideas are interesting, I think. I can't read my own writing sometimes, but something about the process of things breaking down, of systems breaking down, and systems of failure, I think it said at one point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like that notion of, kind of larger cultural glitches,
mm-hmm.
run-ons of sorts. Because I feel like, especially for the last, 15 years or so, there've been this very distinct kind of fashion cycle. That mm-hmm. used to be mostly, kind of fashion pop culture, but I think now it's completely across the board. Where I think it, kind of spread, or at least maybe, maybe I just became, as I got older, I started to realize it more and kind of didn't get carried away by the fashion trends as much. But there's usually kind of an interesting moment that happens between, the kind of two major trends or three major trends or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that where things kind of become more mishmashed and more fluid or more of a hybridic, I guess,
mm-hmm.
to use a somewhat outdated buzzword. which, again, like, that was kind of the funny thing, because, like, hybridic became a thing.
Uh-huh.
And, I guess we had, like, a moment of hybrid, and that went away as well.
Yeah. Just how kind of pop culture, like, generates these new combinations of things that are at one point innovative when they're new and then kind of become cliche or
yeah, and there is a point where like I think it's like right, which used to be I guess right between the underground and the pop. I mean, there's kind of a shift that happens where the identities and the styles and the signifiers, if you will, are much more fluid. And I mean, it just seems to me that that's always been kind of the more interesting stuff. Because, and then, you know, partially because I get bored so easily, which is why I shift gears every few years. Because I don't want it to fall into the specific.
So your own artistic tastes go through that same kind of transition as well, where you get tired of them and
somewhat,
need something new.
Yeah, like I can never like answer, you know, the question of like, who's your favorite blank?
Yeah.
Because it changes sometimes weekly, sometimes annually, sometimes, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mentioned it in terms of like changes in fashion. Were you thinking kind of specifically in that area, or is there like other specific? You also mentioned music.
No, I don't mean fashion as in fashion. I mean fashion as in fashion.
Fashions of,
be it art or music or whatever else. And I mean, it used to be that I guess fashion was just. I mean, it was a much more, I guess, self-aware, cyclical process in fashion, because fashion has seasons, and, you know, there are seasons and shows and specific kind of things that happen at preset days. Like, you have collections that come out twice a year, let's say. And there's, you know, this distinct notion that you have to come up with something new, but of the moment, but not too far away to be not marketable. You know, there's this kind of very self-aware balance with fashion that, in a way, is very honest. Because look, it's, you know, it's a marketable commodity that's also kind of a high art, but it's also kind of this cultural progress marker of sorts. Where art has always kind of, I guess, been more of an avant-garde undertaking, or supposedly at least.
Yeah.
And I think now art is kind of doing the same thing, but still lying to itself about I guess the mechanics, or maybe not anymore. I guess I think everyone pretty much knows it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, kind of these in between season moments is what I guess I'm talking about.
And so following these ideas, how specifically did you decide to approach this in your work? Like, I remember there's a lot of like kind of figures, they're disfigured figures, I guess, or repulsive people in some cases, or kind of grotesque looking people.
Yeah, and I mean the grotesqueness, I guess part of it was just, you know, kind of a natural attraction. I mean, partially because of, I guess, my background, you know, kind of coming out of the Soviet Union, there was a certain aesthetic that was not really allowed, I guess, for the lack of a better word. So, like, we didn't, you know, like, I remember seeing, like, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay.
And, you know, like, at 12, and, like, but you had to go to this thing where you watch it on the video screen, and it was very available, but not directly, I guess, or not commonly available.
Yeah, there wasn't a communist market for, like, that type of material.
It's odd because I guess it was because partially it was kind of a shocking, and this, you know, this culture of shock or this aesthetic of shock that was seen as being capitalist, but or being callous, I guess, to some degree, which were synonymous in that in that culture. But I think also because I think there was just an idea of film and other cultural product being kind of more elevated, and that was seen as just being schlocky.
Yeah.
Also, so there was kind of a double-edged thing about it. But I think because of that, like, you know, when I get started kind of watching horror movies and kind of seeing various things, once I did move to the States, they hit me kind of stronger in a way.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff kind of became more fascinating. I mean, and also just kind of, you know, like looking at Bosch paintings and whatever else when I was a kid, which was kind of my version of watching horror movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's some, I guess, natural attraction that I have to things like that. I mean, partially because it is like, you know, it's the physical outcastness of it.
And so looking through your pieces, do you think most people would be able to identify like direct pop culture influences or references that inform the imagery that you create?
I think it depends on the body of work. You know, like, I guess about, 10 years ago when I first moved to Atlanta, I was making this work that was kind of much more specifically about that. It was, you know, kind of about these very identifiable pop cultural or subcultural, in some cases, moments that were purposefully clashed. Like, you know, goth and hip-hop and heavy metal and
would you just kind of like visually mishmash them together into figures?
Yeah, there were these kind of vignettes that I would make They would have figurative elements, but also would have kind of more abstract and decorative elements, and usually, you know, some sexualized elements, some kind of horror elements. Like, you know, there's this whole body of work I made that was part of the same thing, that was kind of like, you know, hip hop and the rock and wrestle and goth, but it was all kind of made in this zombie mode and before the whole zombie thing became obnoxious. And, you know, partially because, you know, the whole kind of the allegory of those zombie movies, like, you know, the early, like that kind of the post Romero, I mean post, I guess, you know, the post Night of the Living Dead, like the kind of late 70s politicized horror movies, you know, where you have it being much more about the kind of people coming back from Vietnam and brainwashing and kind of these various cultural phenomena.
Are you a zombie movie aficionado? Do you get really, are you really not knowledgeable on them?
I used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
you kind of got out of it before the mid 2000s.
It got like, a little, honestly, like it got a, it got a little hard to take after a while. Like once, you know, the forbiddenness of it, I guess, got sucked out of it. But also, I think because of the, you know, the symbolic kind of, you know, weight of it got completely diffused. Like, you know, they're not about politics or psychology anymore. Like, it's purely just this, you know, fetishized shiny thing that people like. Like, it's, you know, make it wet and gory.
Yeah, they just want to see some blood.
Yeah.
I'm not overly familiar with, I have Night of the Living Dead, but I don't know that many zombie movies. What kind of, like, political themes that you reference were they dealing with? Or,
well, partially, I mean, the reason it was, I guess, attractive or interesting to me at the moment, because a lot of stuff did come out pretty directly out of, with Romero originally, I think, dealing with a lot of issues of, that had to do with civil rights, but also later, I think, with a lot of people that came after him. And I don't remember the names of the movies at this point, because it's been a while. Some of them were very directly about kind of post-traumatic stress, people coming back from Vietnam, people coming back from war. And it was kind of the same moment where, like, the Iraq War was getting into this very obviously kind of history repeating itself moment, where it was definitely kind of the new Vietnam. And there were a lot of things that just kind of, it made sense for me to kind of look back at that moment 20 years ago, and kind of getting back to this whole notion of cycles. Because there was definitely a historical cycle, and there was also a cultural cycle, because, again, I think the whole zombie thing became popular for that very reason, because there were all these things that the culture kind of had to purge. You know, and whether it's, you know, the consumer culture symbolism of that whole aesthetic, or it's the political symbolism of it, and, you know, whatever. But honestly, like, I don't really find it that interesting anymore, because, again, I think it's such a,
that cycle's run out, kind
of. Yeah, I think it's one of those things that people kind of understand without even thinking about it. It's just, it's there. It's kind of built into that aesthetic, and that's why no one really cares anymore. You know it's there. You know it stands for those things, but it doesn't pack any punch anymore.
It's not always the same. Are we even talking about your most recent body of work?
No, no, no. This is, we're talking about the literal body of work from 10 years ago that I've probably made at least three different bodies of work since then, if not four.
Yeah, we can fast forward to what you're doing right now and then work our way back.
I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm kind of curious, like, why you contacted me. Like, what was it that you saw or heard that made you want to do this? I guess, what was it about the work itself?
Yeah, and just seeing your work, it's a little bit genre-defying, but it's part of the aesthetic way that you work is becoming its own genre, where it's kind of doodle-ish. It looks like it has a lot of drug-inspired things going on in there, but I don't know if that's intentional or not.
I mean, it's intentional as a joke. Maybe.
Yeah.
No, what I'm most curious about, I guess, partially, is, you know, which one you saw that sparked your interest, because, you know, I think you're talking about this body of work, and I know this comes off on the podcast very well when I say this and point at something, but I'm not sure if that's the body of work you were talking about, or if it was not this, because this is not online even.
Stuff like that. I see a lot of drug reference in just in the style, the visual style that it's drawn, where like on the figure you have like all these kind of swirling colors that obviously aren't there. So yeah. It's almost hallucinatory seeing this kind of haggard guy crouched on the floor. And
yeah, okay, like that.
Like when you're making a picture like that, like where are you drawing that? The inspiration from to want to make that is.
I mean, there are a number of different things that go into this whole, I guess this image, but also this body of work. Let me see if I can. No, that's a different. With these, I mean, there are, I don't know, 25-ish of them, and I'm still making them whenever I have time. It was a series of small drawings, that are, I think, 6x6, roughly, that are kind of collectively titled Mondegreen, which I don't know if you know the word. Mondegreen is a term for, like, when you hear a lyric, for instance, like, if you listen to a song and you misunderstand the lyric.
Okay.
Like, in the Gana Davi, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this notion of, you know, misinterpreting something, but then that misinterpretation becoming its own entity, which is not, I guess, that far off from what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So these are kind of partially, I was thinking of them in that way. So there are these images that are kind of almost meant to be kind of misinterpretations of things. So, I mean, part of it is actually kind of this genuine appreciation for, like, Peter Doig and kind of painters that actually not necessarily use a psychedelic aesthetic, but kind of use this aesthetic that harkens back to like Gauguin to some degree, but at the same time it's very contemporary or very much kind of its own identity. But also there was, you know, kind of this whole wave of neo-crunch hippieism that I think petered out somewhat.
Yeah, I think that's people a good way of describing your aesthetic. And
yeah, but again, like it was more about kind of poking fun at it than actually indulging it.
Yeah.
But I was also kind of interested in, again, kind of bringing some of the more, and I'm going to make air quotes, more legitimate.
They can hear the air quotes. Yeah. They hear the swoosh when you
the
do
swoosh,
that.
The swoosh, yeah. The more legitimate kind of artwork, again, like Peter Doig or kind of more historic references with this purely somewhat disposable, you know, fashionable doodle mania artwork that was kind of going on at the time.
Yeah.
That probably still does. And, you know, look, a lot of it is also poking fun at myself because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, like, a lot of my earlier work was much more about doodling and kind of making these obnoxious, you know, graffiti, not graffiti-like, but kind of scribbly, you know, figure drawings and kind of, you know, a lot of sexual and violent images and so forth. So this kind of notion of low culture, I guess, being a big component of it. So it was, again, kind of somewhat of a revisionist, self-mocking, something or other. But also a lot of them images that I was interested in, and I was working from photographs but kind of tweaking them. So this was actually drawn from this photograph of albino ape that was, for some reason, completely hairless.
Yeah.
So it literally looked like this oddly deformed old man that was sitting in the zoo.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, and then I kind of threw this roughly, you know, the hair mane is kind of somewhere between Karl Marx and Mendeleev, I guess. Okay, it has this more, I don't know, respectful guys to it, you know, with the beard and the long hair. Yeah, you know, like, or...
Yeah, I saw you scan by one. I think it's like you on a camping trip with the Beach Boys or something.
Oh, this one?
Yeah, that one looks very narrative.
Yeah, yeah, it is. that actually is my head with the beard.
Okay.
Which I did have at the time.
They ripped your head off?
Yeah, but they're actually not Beach Boys, although you are somewhat close.
Oh, I thought that was the title of it.
No, I think I have a bad habit of changing titles. Or maybe, I don't know, a good habit of changing titles.
Yeah.
So sometimes, like, between shows or between publications, the titles would shift. But I think the last title that you probably saw was The Day I Became a Man.
Okay, yeah.
This notion of, you know, rite of passage, I guess. But the foreground, the actual group of the male kind of collective, that group is pretty directly drawn, as far as in body language and so forth, from this photograph from, I think it's a place in Key West, I believe, mm-hmm. that holds an annual Hemingway lookalike contest.
Oh, yeah.
And these were the top 10 or top 5 or whatever, however many of them are so winners. There. So, you know, the guy wearing the giant medallion was actually the first prize. That was the prize.
Oh, that was the first prize,
yeah. And there was, you know, some sort of, I guess, cup or something that they were holding, which, because of kind of this idea of, you know, I mean, it's kind of this cyclical meme almost, like all these people dressing like each other, but also dressing like Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
But also like Hemingway being this odd figure who is kind of very revered, but at the same time is like fairly, I don't know, there's like this macho component to him and his work that mm-hmm. always turned me off, and I think turns a lot of people off. So like it's, I think all of it kind of mixed together. So this kind of idea of rite of passage of becoming a man, you know, this kind of macho Hemingway rite of passage of sorts, where you get decapitated and made into Hemingway. and then, you know, putting it into this kind of campground situation just kind of made sense, putting it into nature, but also, you know, creating this altar-like setting, which is actually the ceiling of a library's where that, I mean, that was that based on turned upside down, and then, you know, there
mm-hmm.
various things in injected into it. And there's still kind of a little bit of that kind of psychedelic-y.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the bright colors and patterns.
Coloration. And I mean, it's all color pencil too, so it's a fairly, I mean, the drawing is, I don't know, 15 inches roughly, like it's, you know.
Mm-hmm. It also kind of references like the kind of music camping festivals that have become so popular in recent years, and that kind of culture of people just going out in the woods and partying and having their own rituals they perform and whatnot.
Yeah, and I guess like also, you know, that whole primal scream culture that I think is completely gone at this point.
Hopefully.
no, I don't mean the band.
No.
that is not gonna die. I don't even know enough about it to rip on it, but I have no interest. I was talking about the primal scream. There was this, and I again don't know much about it. I think it was late '70s, early '80s. There was this movement of people going to the man going into the woods and like running around naked,
sit around
and screaming
in a circle and like cry and stuff.
Yeah, the actual kind
tell
of original
painful stories. Yeah, that's what I was hoping was going.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about the horrible band. I mean, this is just the last, I think this is 2007 or 8 on.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the last 5 years, roughly.
Were there any other pieces that kind of involve these ritualistic things that you were exploring with that there?
This one more, I guess, more directly.
What's happening in this image here?
This one, I mean, the image, the original image that it's based on is actually, I think it was at Reiki, is that how you pronounce it? That
Reiki? What's that?
It's this Japanese.
Oh, Reiki, yeah. Like
Reiki,
the,
yeah.
Kind of placing crystals on your body to heal.
Yeah, it's
something.
This idea, yeah, I guess, of moving energy. Moving
chi.
But again, I was more interested in the image just for the sake of its physicality.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of this idea of a seance or kind of a metaphysical.
Because
I've always kind of had interest in you've been around Michael, so you might have rubbed off him. he kind of instilled this love of alchemy, I think, in me.
Yeah.
which again, like it has. I mean, it's definitely one of those things that it's a well you can go back to, because the long history and the various symbolism of it, and also the fact that it's such a huge part of different cultural pockets.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of, I guess, mysticism and various kind of spiritual and occult practices have always been somewhat interesting to me, but also I didn't want to use them, you know, very directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not necessarily obvious that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I wanted it to be kind of something that's not necessarily specifically like malicious or benevolent or healing, like kind of have this more of a neutral seance. And it's placed into this much more kind of modernist, or I guess maybe even almost brutalist space with kind of this something loosely based on like an African you know, totem, or not totem, but like, you know, fetish sculpture. Which that was kind of a little bit of a nod to Eric Fischel. And I mean, I was reading an old interview with him when I was working on this, just purely coincidentally. And he was talking about kind of how he would sneak in these little images. Oftentimes it would be like African fetish figurines or kind of various sculptural moments into his, you know, tableau or his, the scenes that he would paint. And they kind of became this idea of, I guess, like an art observer of sorts, or a historical observer, or a cultural other. And I was kind of interested in that idea, you know, kind of injecting this specifically kind of cultural, I guess, moment into this much more spiritual, much more hermetic, I guess, moment.
And were there some other images that were related to that?
Yeah, I mean, there were, I've only made three of them, and I kind of want to go back and make more. I just honestly haven't had the time with all of this going on. Even though it's been probably over a year since I made these. I've been kind of working on other stuff, but these, I guess, required a little bit more concentration. So I've only made three of them. And this one kind of has some of the similar themes, but on much more...
Is this also a large Reiki session that we're looking at? It looks kind of like a group meeting of some kind.
Yeah, this is, it's actually a combination of two separate scenes. And so almost, not entirely down the middle, but you can kind of find the scene if you look close enough. One of them is from this, I think, 70s Eastern European art collective kind of discussion. So it's this, you know, very serious turtleneck, turtlenecked kind of group of people discussing art, you know, with hands on their chins and so forth.
Yeah.
And the other one is actually from a political meeting. And the two kind of oddly overlap each other in an interesting way.
They look like they fit well together.
And I was kind of interested in, you know, this idea of, I guess, academia as this, which kind of came out of some of the earlier work, like the work I was showing you earlier, these. Because these were kind of combinations of two different types of spaces, or three sometimes, didactic spaces like lecture halls, and, you know, there'll be like projection screens and various kind of didactic props, and the old military installations, predominantly like Cold War Russian installations or Soviet installations. And in occasionally kind of, you know, more about to put it into this more mystic context, you know, this is from a cave, the stalactites. So I was kind of interested in combining these two things, primarily for the focus, for the purpose of kind of distilling this remnants of Marxism that are very much present in both of those things, like, you know, the art academia, which has been Marxist, you know, for the last, what, 60 years or so, if not more. And obviously, you know, the Cold War Soviet installations are very much kind of aggressively based in Marxism. So one is this kind of, you know, very coached academic form of Marxism that's purely academic and kind of more hypothetical and theoretic, which is very interesting, and which I kind of very invested in and kind of believe a lot of it, or it aligns with my beliefs in many ways. And then there's this kind of the more real world application of Marxism that obviously misfired in many horrible ways, but also had some interesting moments to it. But, you know, the way I always saw it is like it's basically a very benevolent kind of good idea that gets undermined by basic kind of human nature, because someone takes advantage of it and grabs for the for the ring and becomes a dictator, essentially. Which is not the intention of anyone, but that's what happens time and time again, it seems like.
That's also that kind of cycle that you're getting back to again, where something is built and then falls apart, and
And it's like something
potential that, to build again, I suppose.
And I was making this work that was again partially about this idea of kind of what happened to Marxism, like what happened to these ideals, that I grew up with and that I think many people are still very much kind of invested in.
Mm-hmm.
Partially again, kind of, you know, like I think I was reading a lot of Zizek at the time, mm-hmm. as everyone was, I think, at the time. And, you know, he kind of talks about this idea that we don't really believe in any change anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we kind of, we have all made peace that we're going to live with capitalism. And yeah. we just try to make capitalism as social as we can. Where, you know, if you look 60 years ago, you know, this idea of actually many different political approaches, many viewpoints was much more active or much more alive.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, that was part of it. But also, let me see if I can, sorry, I know this is not helping anyone but us, but there was also... Well, there were these, which are actually portraits of Yuri Gagarin in various stages of his life and various guises.
Was he the first man in space?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which again, like, as when I was growing up, it was kind of, you know, it was the picture on the wall. It was
okay.
It was like the childhood idol of mm-hmm. everyone I knew. And again, kind of this idea of hope that got soiled, or, you know, in some mm-hmm. way. Not that his image got soiled anyway, but, you know, there's kind of this notion of.
At what stages of his life did you depict
Well, there was kind of, you know, this is from his college years, and it's actually cropped. It's kind of him and his friend hugging this skeleton, you know, this, I guess, anatomical prop in the skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking very young, and kind of you keep looking like a lot of people you would probably see, like, in any college room.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, this, which is from his official photograph that you would, you know, find.
That's what would be up on the wall.
Yeah. And then there was another image, which I'm not sure if I have in this... I mean, you know, I don't know if we need to go between, like, multiple screens and whatever.
Yeah.
There was basically a picture of him when he was younger, but already in the military, dressed up in this Poseidon
mm-hmm.
Costume for... I mean, there's just... I don't know if it's something that is familiar to the day of Neptune or the Poseidon day,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of people kind of do it, you know, when you cross the equator.
Okay.
If you're in the Navy or if you're traveling, that's kind of a common thing. But there are also, like, a lot of places that were, you know, on seacoast and whatever, kind of would have the celebration of kind of the Poseidon Day. And it was just, you know, this
uh-huh.
kind of marine Halloween parade thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's like him as the Poseidon figure.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you're kind of wearing, like, little swimming shorts and whatever. So it's kind of this very playful but very kind of heroic at the same time
mm-hmm.
the figure. And there was also an image that I'm not sure if it's even in this slideshow... which, I mean, I can pull up if need be, but of Gorbachev, which was drawn directly from a Louis Vuitton ad,
uh-huh.
which I think was a maybe Marc Jacobs.
Louis Vuitton used a Gorbachev photo.
No. Gorbachev actually posed for the Louis Vuitton promotional campaign.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, they weren't like recycling some old social men, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was actually kind of not a spokesperson for them, but he was, you know, he was a model for one of the shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of him in the back of a limousine with this Louis Vuitton bag and kind of looking very tired. I think driving through Berlin, you can kind of see maybe the remnants of the wall behind him. It's like something that seems very much of that, you know, post-wall coming down Berlin. And that was happening like right around the time of last elections, like, what, 2008.
Uh-huh.
And there was, you know, and this is going to be something that people always hate when I bring this up, but I think, like, the Shepard Fairey poster came out about that time,
mm-hmm.
which personally, like, I find really obnoxious. And kind of this notion of, you know, this Obama becoming this messianic figure, like this hope, you know, this beacon of hope,
mm-hmm.
Reminded me just, like, you know, thinking of, like, the Gorbachev coming to power, and kind of he was that figure.
He was,
and
the
he really kind of
Obama.
He was in many ways, yeah. And he kind of fulfilled a lot of those promises in many ways, you know. And yes, the country did fall apart as the result of that. But then he kind of, you know, became this again, this symbolic figure for, you know, the lost hope, and also kind of being blamed for the you know, the dissolving this great country.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of this, again, kind of this idea of tainted hope. I think he very much embodies that. And I was kind of thinking of almost kind of, you know, this, or as I'm pointing at the image that's not there,
mm-hmm.
This you know, this image of him in very tired in the back of a limousine with the Louis Vuitton bag as being kind of the Obama poster in 20 years in a way.
Yeah.
And again, kind of going back to the idea of cycles, but also going back to this idea that, you know, you can't, like, no one can live up to this messianic ideal. Like, you can't put someone on a pedestal like that and expect them to not crumble. Which I think we kind of saw with Obama. I think he did actually fairly well, all things considered, considering how much people piled on him.
Yeah.
Because no one could live up to what was expected of him 4 years ago. Like, that's just not possible.
Yeah.
You can't just save everyone by, you know, with a magic wand.
Yeah, what I also found was people were, like, omitting parts of what he was saying that they didn't want to hear, and then they'd like be shocked when he did things he said he was gonna do, and I'm like, well, you're just idealizing him being through this, like, you see that hope ad and, like, you think that, oh, he represents everything that I think is awesome, and
and
that's not possible.
So, like, a lot of that work was very much about this idea of kind of unfulfilled hope, like, really that whole kind of, you know, somewhat pixelated,
all the combinations of different scenes and
And I mean, they were kind of made that way. The reason I was making them with these kind of hash marks is really to mimic embroidery, is what I was looking at.
Okay,
embroidery being something that's this very deliberate, slow process, but also kind of a process of kind of making a memorial to something, or making this thing that's meant to be kind of cherished and passed on. Oftentimes, like, you know, if you think about what embroidery oftentimes is, and there were also these images in the same series. There, well, two of those, and these are actually drawn directly from the backs of DVD boxes of two films.
Okay.
So this is from the back of a Caligula, the Italian edition of Caligula, and this is from the back of I think the Japanese edition of Holy Mountain, both of which are kind of these failed epics.
Okay.
As opposed to epic fails. It's like a horrible pun, but I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's really what I was interested in, is the fact that there were these very epic narratives that kind of didn't live up to anyone's expectations. And they're still kind of very interesting, and kind of somewhat, like in the case of Holy Mountain, it's kind of a brilliant cultural artifact, but it's also a complete failure at the same time. And the end is great epic at the same time.
And I wasn't aware that Caligula was not a successful movie. I mean, it's
I mean, I can't remember the whole backstory, but, you know, it was basically people disavowed. The director left.
Yeah.
I think Gore Vidal took his name off the movie. There was, there was this whole... And it was basically edited by, like, what, Bob Guccione at the end? as this, like, kind of crappy porn movie, but it has, like, Malcolm McDowell and Helen Mirren and, like, Peter O'Toole in it, and so it's, like, this really odd thing where, like, you know, when would you expect to see, like, these great, like, Shakespearean actors in essentially, like, this cheesy softcore, like, hardcore really movie. And that's also very epic, and it has, like, some great moments, but also has some horribly cheesy moments. And I think the end result is kind of a fairly failed attempt, but it kind of fails. It's very grand, you know, on this grandiose level. Like, it's a grand failure.
And I'm not familiar with the other movie that you mentioned.
Oh, Holy Mountain. If you're not familiar, I would strongly recommend. I mean, I think it is, like, it's a movie that I think everyone has to see, just for the sake of, like, being able to kind of have that reference point culturally. I mean, it's probably the most elaborate and probably the most successful and the most kind of, I think, revered to some degree, like, kind of psychedelic epic.
Okay.
But it's also somewhat self-aware, because it's somewhat self-mocking, because he kind of flips it onto itself in the end, not to spoil it. But yeah, I would strongly recommend to anybody to watch that. And really any Jodorowsky movie. I mean, I think 90% of what he's made has been brilliant in its own way.
Yeah. And so you were mentioning in some of your other pieces in this series how it was meant to be... look like Needlepoint and
all of them really are, like, you know, you can kind of
look like a kind of monument to something. Does that carry over into the series that was next to that, that's got the grid paper, because that's kind of like the layout for Needlepoint sometimes? The graph paper
somewhat. I mean, I honestly, like, it wasn't a very aware transition, but that I think it was a big part of it, because the grid is really was the part of the thing that I was interested in the most. Partially because of this kind of, I guess, legacy of modernist grid, but also partially because it is, like, essentially a very craft-based substrate. Like, it's a very craft-like surface. And, you know, I'm making joints on essentially, like, this is from an architect, I think it's an architectural diary or architectural journal, I guess, paper that has, like, numbered pages. You can see them there.
Okay. Yeah, this scene that we're looking at right there looks like it's got some alchemical narrative or scene in there. Is that what that is? Or?
Yeah, but these also were kind of a way... This and kind of the body of work that kind of came out of this that's a little bit more, I guess, abstract and decorative at the same time were in a way like much more unfiltered. Mm-hmm. Where like, you know, the work... This work was very deliberate because it was... I would, you know, find photographs, make these Photoshop collages, mm-hmm. would go through multiple, you know, manifestations or kind of multiple versions of these Photoshop images, and then I would draw them fairly directly, and they would get abstracted more through this, again, this embroidery mimicking, which would be, again, the distortion part of it.
Uh-huh.
Where these were drawn completely, like, free flow. Uh-huh. There was no plan when I was starting them. And I kind of enjoyed it. It was just kind of, in a way, a fun thing to do. And partially because, like, my life was in a fairly complicated moment, and still is to some degree, as you can see. So it was kind of a way to let things out in a way. Like, it's almost kind of a meditative process.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a way of coping with things to some degree, processing things.
Mm-hmm. So what did you come up with some of these, and how were you just filling in around these squares and just kind of building the forms?
I mean, with some of the early ones and also with some of the later ones, there was kind of a transition in between. I would make these pattern-like kind of, but something that was both pattern and structure, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You can see kind of, you know, there's basically a central axis and there's somewhat of a symmetry, but also I didn't want them to be completely symmetrical because, again, it seemed like that kind of became this very common thing as well. There was kind of this, again, I think fashion for symmetry that cropped up, which some of it is really interesting and some of it is just purely surface-based.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of playing with the idea of symmetry, but at the same time trying to consciously let it shift and slide a little bit so things don't quite align or don't completely mirror each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in this case, like, it's a fairly mirrored image with a few little exceptions, but I also kind of wanted it to look like a head, like almost like this Greek kind of sculptural head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that in the form there.
But, you know, also kind of trying to create this almost video noise through the grid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the pattern and kind of this symmetrical structure is what began it, but then I kind of shaped it as a kind of almost sculpted into this head in the end and then filled in the black. And there's a little bit of gray and black and blue in there as well, but it's, you know, like, I can zoom in and you can probably see the differences, but...
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of the same thing, but without a distinct subject matter. This is much more about the feel of it, kind of having this almost iceberg like, or like, you know, kind of with this icy landscape feel to it. And, you know, I was always kind of interested in playing with decoration kind of as a mode of abstraction, I guess, and some of them are much more directly decorative, some are much less, or much more painterly in some cases, but that also kind of led to this work.
So yeah, here you're still working on the same paper, but it's very dense pencil work instead of just filling in to create the images.
And part of it is kind of, you know, this idea of almost embroidery-like density. And, you know, this idea of craft being a huge part of it. This repetitive mark-making being... I mean, in a way, I think they became work, like almost kind of in this Richter-like sense, you know, where this was what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was kind of a 9-to-5 kind of thing that was a way to apply myself, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there were kind of a lot about that, this whole work, partially because I was, you know, we just moved to New York, I was looking for jobs, we didn't have a house, we didn't have, like, we were completely in flux, and kind of having this thing that I could do as work and feel fulfilled at the end of the day was very important, and these kind of became that. So they're somewhat self-indulgent in that sense, but also I kind of find them interesting visually as well. And I don't think there's really much more beyond that in them. I mean, there are, you know, certain references in there to patterns and kind of, again, alchemic diagrams and, you know, maybe even like a little bit of a Blakean aspect and, you know, this idea of repetitive obsessive mark making and patterning and whatever else. But at the end of the day, that, to me, they were much more about, again, labor.
Just the time spent creating a product.
Well, yeah, but also, you know, kind of this idea of almost kind of them being, I mean, the process-based art, essentially, to put it bluntly, but without kind of some kind of grand conceptual statement. They were literally about just doing work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this idea of, I guess, dig a ditch, fill it up.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of, without being that pointless about it, like, I wanted to have something at the end of the day from, I guess, purely narcissistic standpoint.
Isn't that what broke Cool Hand Luke down?
I hate to admit it, but I've never actually seen Cool Hand Luke, even though I know I should.
Yeah, in that movie, he...
But that's where it comes from, right?
He's rebellious, and they can't break him, but eventually they do by, like, he has to dig a ditch, and he's like, why are you digging that hole in my yard? Fill it up. And then he's like, I told you to dig a ditch, dig the ditch. And after, like, 3 or 4 times, he breaks, and they break him down.
Yeah, I think I've heard the expression, dig a ditch, fill it up, but I didn't actually know the exact source of it, but that makes sense. I thought it would be a little bit more zen, I guess, but maybe not.
It could have a root in that. It does sound very zen.
Yeah, I don't know. So that's kind of where these came out of. That's one of the benefits of working.
Very prolific.
But it's also one of the benefits of working small, because most of my work is, you know, fairly portable.
Yeah.
So, which partially, you know, obviously takes less time to make something smaller, but it's also much easier to do something much more kind of obsessive and detailed when I can do it anywhere.
Because
I can literally, you know, pull a joint out. Oh, these are collaborations with Mark Husford. These are fairly new. These are from a year ago, maybe a little more now. I guess a year and a half now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of see a lot of the more doodly.
I'm not familiar with that artist. I'm not familiar with that artist. What kind of work do they do?
Mark's work is... I think the other drawing is probably a little bit more telling of what he's been doing lately.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I would just recommend looking him up, because I think he's great artist and a, you know, great guy. But he also went to KU, that's why I thought he might.
Okay.
But he went there at the same time I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did this show together that had some collaborative work and some of our own work that was called Sasnak, which is Kansas backwards, which is also apparently this notorious strip club in Topeka, as I found out after Googling Sasnak.
Do they beat you out in the Google search results, probably?
Honestly, I have no idea. I haven't tried Googling it since we named the show that. I'm not sure if I Googled it after the show went up. I don't know.
And so these recent gridded drawings that we were just looking at a second ago, that's the most recent stuff that you've done.
It's the most recent stuff, I think, time-wise, but in a way, like, I feel like that's probably the work that is more of a transitional work.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily kind of that I'm going to abandon it, but I also feel like it's work that would be a good way to provide context for other work that actually has, you know, more specific figuration or narrative content or symbolic content.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were feeling like you might be kind of close to the end of that and ready to move on to the next phase, whatever that may
be. Yeah, I think once I have my studio set up, I'm going to go back to probably these. That would be my intention.
Outdoor
that,
camping.
Yeah, the
Hemingways.
not, I don't mean subject matter-wise, but I think as far as the aesthetics and the construction and, you know, the use of figuration...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the color will probably change, because I don't think I'm going to go quite that bright and trippy at this point. I am interested in kind of going back to doing some figurative work, and, you know, probably making more of these as well, because they're a lot faster and, you know, they're small joints where I can work through ideas much more efficiently. And I mean, that was kind of the point of these, you know, the whole notion of Mondo Greens is that they are kind of these ephemeral, misheard things. So it was a way to kind of, you know, have it, kind of thinking of images as almost, I guess, aphorisms versus novels.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of these little, you know, wordplays or word, you know, glitches or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it was also a way of kind of pulling completely different types of imagery into this more consistent stream.
Yeah, some of your figures in here look like recognizable people, like Frank Zappa or something. Is that supposed to be?
No, that was actually, I was loosely drawing it from the Civil War photograph.
Okay.
So, it was definitely some old military image. I can't remember exactly which one it was, because that was a while ago. But this idea of pageantry, I think, was kind of really appealing to me. This, you know, people kind of posing for a portrait in all their regalia.
Mm-hmm. Trying to make themselves look important together.
Yeah, but there's also, I think, this idea of kind of, I don't know, like dandyism, like military dandyism, that's kind of interesting about it.
Yeah.
Like, they're kind of, you know, it's someone who, like, by profession is supposed to be very stoic and kind of, I guess, you know, when you put your life on the line, I guess the notion of pride is defined in a completely different way than we would.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they dress up and, you know, there's this kind of very dandy-like aspect to, like, dressing up in full, you know, parade uniform and full regalia for, and sitting for a portrait or for a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it was just kind of a fun image to play with, you know, kind of making it into this, I don't know, mutated thing.
Yeah, if there's one common thread that I can find through your work, it's probably that it's all got a lot of fun in it. It's fun to look at.
I hope so.
It's good.
Because honestly, like, humor was, I mean, probably not as much with some of the later work, but, you know, it's always something that I found very important to making work.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, whether it's visual humor or something more direct or more, I don't know, subversive or more gutter humor, bathroom humor, whatever it might be in various cases. I kind of have an interest in, you know, just humor as an art form, I guess, to some degree. Like, I mean, I've always kind of, again, this is one of those things that doesn't mean anything, I guess, to anyone else. But like, I always kind of like the idea of watching comedy, especially, like, if you look at stand-up comedy historically, as being this weird, like, barometer for culture. Like, what's allowed, what's not allowed, because it's, you know, it's essentially about pushing this collective boundaries of acceptability and taste.
And so what I have noticed that in comedy is that people are always able to make jokes about, like, religion and politics, and it's like they go through these cycles where we keep running into the same walls. It's like, do we actually accomplish nothing?
We're running
into the same things and making the same criticisms, but
yeah, and, you know, there's also kind of the again, the devil's advocate to some degree point of view that you know, it's basically kind of the court jester. It's a way for people to let off steam so they don't actually go into the streets and carry signs. You can just go into the safe environment of a comedy club or concert hall and laugh and let it out.
Yeah,
and then you don't want to go and pick up a brick and, you know, actually do something physical or violent or aggressive or, you know, real in a way. I think there's, like, a Peter Lawson essay, The Spy in the Mall, I think, where he actually talks about a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I might be completely misremembering what the source here, but yeah. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting way of, like, you know, this idea of licensed sarcasm or licensed you know, criticism in a comedic form being, in a way, not even licensed, I guess sanctioned would be a better way to put it. Kind of being a very deliberate thing on, you know, on the part of whoever's in charge, or, like, the powers that be, again, to kind of to create this valve for people.
Cool. I think I'm about finished.
As I mentioned, I can ramble and ramble, but yeah, someone needs to put a stop to it.
I'll slam the bricks.
Right.
It's good talking to you.
Right, good talking to you.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Alex Kvarez. You can find his work online at alexcavarez.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattcoolman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send a dollar, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.